This is the sound of getting stuck in the mud in Chad on the way to Gaga camp.
Whether you're stuck in the mud in Chad or stuck at home in the States, no worries. This week, the World Vision Report brings you a staycation special just made for armchair traveling. In Nigeria, we meet the country's first lady mechanic.
Is it that Sandra is an ugly woman, that's why she's a mechanic? But I know that I'm not even ugly, I'm a queen.
In Liberia, we get the news from a chalkboard on the street. And we make hot chocolate, Mexican style.
Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandma.
All aboard with the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. If you travel to Liberia, you'll see that local news is hard to come by. There's not much radio or television, and newspapers are of little use since most Liberians can't read. But all you have to do is stroll down a busy street in the capital to find out what's really going on in this West African country. That's where one innovative Liberian has taken local news into his own hands, literally. Prue Clark has the story from Monrovia.
It's early morning on Tubman Boulevard, the busy main road that leads into the heart of Liberia's capital, Monrovia. Alfred Sirleaf has some breaking news. He reads out the headline he's written neatly on a large three-panelled blackboard. Local people crowd around, even passing cars slow down.
Several hundred criminals walked out of the South Beach jail unscratched.
Amid tight security in Monrovia.
Sirleaf's chalkboard also demands answers.
This is maximum prison center.
This was a maximum prison center in the Republic.
And it was just wide open and all of the
And it was just wide open. And all of the criminals just walked out of the cell. It was very mysterious.
Who blundered, he asks.
The people want to know the truth. Is there a right?
Welcome to today's edition of the Daily Talk, a blackboard newspaper put out by the 35-year-old Sirleaf.
Okay, this is my newsroom. Okay.
This is my newsroom.
The newsroom is actually a little wooden hut right on Tubman Boulevard that he built himself. In place of one of the walls, there's a blackboard. Inside, it's just wide enough for the two of us. Sirleaf has only an 11th grade education, but he operates like any dedicated journalist. He's already scoured the papers and talked to sources who call from all over the city to give him tips.
Okay, so bucket of water here, and then I get the cloth.
Then he cleans yesterday's news off the board with a wet rag and carefully writes today's copy. The Daily Talk is quick to the point. There are no more than three or four concise stories, each a few paragraphs long.
President Sirleaf meets heads of political parties.
President Sirleaf meets heads of political parties to reduce poverty in Liberia.
That's Liberia's president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, no relation. The Daily Talk has a distinctly different flavour from newspapers here. Most are owned by politicians or business leaders and strongly reflect the owner's view. What's more, most journalists aren't paid by their employer. Instead, they're paid so-called expenses by the person they're writing about. Needless to say, it's a system that encourages corruption. Sirleaf, on the other hand, doesn't get paid. He gets by like other Liberians here with no formal employment, bartering and living by his wits. It's not been easy, but he's kept the Daily Talk free and he's proud of that independence.
But everything I say, yeah, is credible, it's reliable, and, you know, and the reading public can count on me for what I put here.
But the Daily Talk's most distinguishing feature is the language in which it's written. Newspapers here use florid formal English most Liberians can't understand. Sirleaf uses the street words Liberians actually speak.
So instead of corruption, we use stealing.
Instead of corruption, we use stealing.
And when there's a rampant corruption, we use the word big stealing. We don't use the word embezzlement.
We don't use the word embezzlement.
It's estimated more than half Liberians are illiterate. Many more can only barely read. So for them, Sirleaf's come up with an elaborate language of symbols and pictures. For example, when the story involves the UN peacekeeping mission here, he puts a peacekeeper's trademark blue helmet on a stake in front of the board to signal what the story's about. He also has a special symbol for President Johnson Sirleaf.
for President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, I had a steel plate there, you know.
For President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, I have a steel plate there. Whenever I use it, people know exactly that's the Iron Lady. She has been considered the Iron Lady in the Liberian political arena.
When the Daily Talk appears this morning, a crowd is already waiting. Some read quietly, others pass on the news to those who can't read. Most of Sirleaf's audience wear the bedraggled garb of Liberia's poor. Once the news is up, Sirleaf leaves to go about his day. The news stays out until he comes to replace it the next morning. Sirleaf claims 5,000 readers each day. If he's right, that would make the Daily Talk the most read news source in Liberia. One of the readers is 22-year-old Cooper. He's a college student who says he can't afford to buy a newspaper.
Do you read Daily Talk?
Of course, I read every day.
Why?
Because it is very much educative, you know.
Because it is very informative. Nowadays, not everyone has access to newspapers. By reading this, it has educated us a lot.
A policeman standing by agrees.
They want to make it simple for us, for those who do not read to the highest standard.
It makes it simple for us who do not read to the highest standard. It's important because it made people who are not in the higher class to understand for themselves.
Under the brutal regime of former President Charles Taylor, journalists could be killed, jailed, or forced into exile. Taylor's security guards threatened Sirleaf and destroyed his board several times. Those days are over. The current president has complained about Sirleaf's occasionally critical coverage of her. But now, instead of making him fear for his life, that reaction makes him smile. Today the public can debate openly in the free market of ideas. And Sirleaf says his newspaper helps them do that.
If they are well informed of unfolding development...
If they are well informed of unfolding developments...
Tomorrow, if somebody say, look... Vote for me.
If somebody says, this, vote for me,
do that,
or do this or do that, they're going to think wisely and know which direction to go in.
It all helps to move society forward.
So it all helps to move society forward.
Alfred Sirleaf would like to see his blackboard idea spread across the country, but he's found no businesses or aid groups willing to fund it. His readers, meanwhile, give him the only things they have, thanks and the occasional stick of chalk. For now, that's enough to keep him writing. I'm Prue Clark in Monrovia, Liberia, for the World Vision Report.
New York City has its fair share of people hawking on the streets, everything from bags to scarves to food, of course. Reporter Sherry Fink met a woman who sells tamales made in her Harlem kitchen.
Tamales, tamales! I step out of the subway on the way home from work. And her voice is always the first one that greets me.
Tamales, tamales, los tamales, tamales, tamales.
She stands on a street corner by the subway exit every day and every night but Sunday.
What's your name?
My name is Yolanda.
What are you selling?
Hot tamales, Mexican food.
Are you from Mexico?
Acapulco, Guerrero.
But Yolanda has hawked tamales here, on a single sidewalk spot in West Harlem, for 11 years. Her days start early in a tiny kitchen stacked with bags of cornmeal.
I don't like cucarachas. Cucarachas? You know the cucarachas?
Oh, cockroaches?
Uh-huh.
Yolanda says her kitchen is painted yellow to keep away the cockroaches.
I need my kitchen very clean for my food.
As Mexican ranchera music plays on the CD player, Yolanda's assistant uses a gloved hand to scoop up cornmeal and press it into a corn husk. Then he adds a pinch of shredded chicken or pork and folds the husk closed. He places it to steam on the stove atop a towering pile of tamales. When the tamales are done, about an hour later, Yolanda stacks them into a Coleman cooler lined with garbage bags to keep them warm. Then she places the cooler on a grocery cart, which she bumps down the steps of her apartment building.
Jennifer está gorda. It's very heavy. It's very heavy. God.
It's a 9-block walk down Broadway to the corner where Yolanda works. On the way, we pass other street vendor offerings. Pineapple slices on sticks, sweet fried churros, and a shaved ice treat called raspado.
How you doing, man? How you doing? Today's about perfect day.
We also pass a man begging for spare change. The man speaks perfect English, a real American. Yolanda comments on this to me. She can't understand why the man is asking her for help.
Why the man, he want money? He is Americano, you know. He got a social security, everything. You know, me, immigrante.
Inmigrante means immigrant. Yolanda has no social security card. She speaks little English, and with a workday that lasts 16 hours, she has no time to go to school to learn. She has no license to sell her tamales, and she's been robbed by thieves and ticketed by police. Still, she works 6 days a week, rain, snow, or shine, until the last tamale sells, still hot, usually around midnight. She says the reason she works so hard is her children. Both her son and daughter want to be doctors.
So I need money for my son, my daughter.
How many more years do you want to do this job?
I need 10 years.
10 more years?
Yeah. When my son is ready, the school, maybe.
And so she feeds her loyal customers on the street.
Tamales, tamales, los tamales.
Pork tamales, sweet tamales, tamales, spicy chicken tamales, $1 each. A regular named Hector stops by and devours his on the spot.
How is it?
Good. This is good. She makes it good. I try other people, but she's the best.
She's the best.
You want some?
Yolanda's customers seem to rely on her as much as she relies on them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sherry Fink in New York City.
Tamales, tamales, los tamales, tamales, tamales.
Yolanda probably stored her homemade food in her refrigerator. That's just what the Chinese government wants its people to do. Here's our globe at a glance. Home appliances go rural. That's a slogan on banners slung across the front of retail stores in rural China. It's part of a pilot program urging farmers to buy refrigerators and other locally made appliances. The carrot is a 13% rebate for each rural family who buys a TV, fridge, or mobile phone. The Chinese government wants its rural population to start spending more money. They're hoping to kickstart consumption in rural areas where there's a huge pool of untapped customers. 750 million, to be precise. Until recently, China has relied on overseas demand to spur its phenomenal economic growth, but now it wants to increase domestic spending, starting with refrigerators. If the pilot program works, and brisk sales seem to indicate it is, the government has suggested that washing machines may be next. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. You're listening to the World Vision Report. Fed up with your staycation this summer? Here's a reminder that traveling also can be tough. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. We're taking you now to Nigeria, to the sprawling port city of Lagos. That's where you'll meet a group of women who've defied traditional roles and work in a business that used to be just for men, Sarah Simpson explains.
It's another hot and sticky day in Lagos, and the traffic is, as usual, horrendous. I'm not going to let that put me off, though, since I'm on my way to a very special car repair shop.
You tell them to start the car, then.
As soon as you enter this open yard, it's quite plain what makes this place so extraordinary. Practically all the 20 or so mechanics working on vehicles here today are young women. Some of the girls are gathered around a car with its hood up, testing each other on their engine knowledge. Another team are servicing a car, singing as they work. The lady mechanic's garage is a no-frills operation. There's no grease pit, no mechanized winch to lift engines. Amario Noisu is 23 and has been in training here for a few months. Today, she's under the hood of a car servicing the engine.
To service a car, it's easy for me. But to drop an engine, it's very heavy, very complicated and so on. So, but still, I have to try to. assistant so that I can learn more about it.
All the girls here are dressed in bright yellow overalls. Some of the girls are Muslims, like 18-year-old Ajima Busari. She says her faith does not restrict her. Neither does her headscarf, which she tucks neatly into the neck of her overalls.
Being a Muslim doesn't say you should not become.
Being a Muslim, she says, doesn't mean that a woman should not become whatever she wants to become. The woman behind all this is 35-year-old Sandra Agwebo. She says she's Nigeria's first female car mechanic, and from what anyone can tell, she's correct. Sandra first became interested in car mechanics as a girl of 14, but her father initially laughed off her ambitions. He finally relented. So, after school, Sandra would put away her books, change out of her uniform, and work as an apprentice with a local mechanic. Now, with nearly 20 years in the trade, Sandra has a thriving repair business. And a few years ago, she started another enterprise called the Lady Mechanic Initiative. Sandra says she was frustrated at the sight of otherwise competent women buckling when confronted with simple car problems like a flat tire.
I took it upon myself to start going on outreach program to talk to women, car owners, that you must know something about your car. That will even reduce costs for you. That is how I started the Lady Mechanic Initiative program.
Eventually, the initiative developed into an apprenticeship program that takes up to 2 years to complete. Sitting in her small office, Sandra explains that her free training program is especially geared toward the poor and undereducated.
The Lady Mechanic Initiative works with the less privileged, the vulnerables, and those orphans. And also the Lady Mechanic works with the ex-sex workers, the school certificate holders who could not finish their education for any reason.
While training, the girls get a monthly allowance of about $25. They can expect to earn nearly 10 times that once employed, perhaps more if they open their own garage. In a country where most people exist on less than $2 a day, that's good earning potential. And it seems that discrimination isn't a problem. Sandra says all the program's graduates have found employment as mechanics with various companies across Nigeria. Sandra seems to be more than just a business role model for these young women. That's because she operates with quite a flair. For one, she likes flamboyant clothes, often topping off her work gear with an outrageous fake tiger skin cowboy hat. The message to her students is clear.
I am a mechanic. What stops another woman from doing this? Is it that Sandra is an ugly woman, that's why she's a mechanic? But I know that I'm not even ugly, I'm a queen. And you know, these women can also do this and also be a queen. Of course, they are beautiful women. But you can still be beautiful as a woman and be a motor mechanic. Nothing stops you.
Sandra tells her apprentices that car repair skills will win the admiration of any worthy husband.
Yes, you know, women, they'll just be looking at the cars. What will I do? They take up their mobile phone, they'll start calling their husband, honey, my car is broken down, the tire is flat. And the man is like, wow, the tire flat, okay, let me send somebody to help you. But as a woman, if you know what to do at that particular time, you can change your tire and you not call your husband up, honey, look, my tire, I had a flat tire, but I've changed it myself. Now I'm on my way home. The man would like, wow, this is my wife. And the man would be so proud of you.
Sandra has many plans for the future, including an emergency breakdown and recovery service, especially for women. But whatever comes next, she says, God will guide her.
Since it's servicing, first of all, you gauge the two.
Back in the yard, girls crowd around an old dump truck to learn how to bleed a fuel pipe. Before long, they'll be on their own, perhaps teaching other young women their skills. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sarah Simpson in Lagos, Nigeria.
Journalist Michael Kavanaugh could have used the help of the lady mechanics. His car got stuck on a reporting assignment in Chad. He was interviewing refugees who had fled there from Darfur. We asked Michael to send us a story about what it's like to report from a place where just getting around is a job in itself.
I was on my way to a 9 a.m. meeting at the Gaga refugee camp in eastern Chad. This drive is supposed to take just over an hour, but I gave myself three because, well, this is Chad. There are only about 300 miles of paved roads in the entire country, and it was still the rainy season when a little precipitation can turn a dirt road into a thick soup in minutes. But I'd spent $200 on a driver and a Land Cruiser to avoid this problem, and when we set off, the forecast was clear. Then, about 30 minutes from the camp, the rain began.
This is sound of getting stuck in the mud in Chad on the way to Gaga camp.
By the time I started recording this, we'd been stuck in the mud for 2.5 hours.
Come on.
Technically, French is one of Chad's official languages, along with Arabic. But my driver, Abdullahi, spoke as much French as he did English, which is to say, none. And none is exactly how much Arabic I speak. When he picked me up this morning, he'd looked like a sultan, in a flowing ochre robe and a bleached white turban. Once the car got stuck, his robes came off, and he turned into this skinny guy in gym shorts, madly digging before the giant 4x4 sunk too deep into the mud. We grunted at each other. I took off my shirt and started digging beside him. Whenever you think you're out in the middle of nowhere in a place like Eastern Chad, it's amazing how quickly someone finds you. Within 10 minutes, a half dozen kids from a nearby village arrived. Since they were all about the age when playing in the mud was still fun, they immediately jumped under the car and started digging.
Poussez. Un, deux, trois.
But the Land Cruiser wouldn't budge.
Not again.
Three women on mules rode by, laughing. They knew that for the amount of money I paid for my 4x4, I could have bought a dozen mules and rode one of them to the camp in 30 minutes. 5 hours later, we were still there, digging away. Finally, around 1 p.m, a worker from the refugee camp happened to pass by on his motorbike. I hopped on the back, covered in mud and looking like a refugee myself, leaving my driver and his gaggle of pint-sized helpers behind. Midway through my last interview at the refugee camp, my translator stopped me. Isn't that your car? He asked me in French. And from across the plains, underneath a cloud-filled sky that stretched for miles, came a speeding Land Cruiser. My Land Cruiser. As the car approached, it seemed a slice of sun shone through the clouds, and I laughed. I said one of the few phrases I knew in Arabic. God be praised. The difficulty of reporting from a place mired in poverty and conflict like Chad is that it's actually normal for things not to work. But what's most strange about a place like this is that things still usually work themselves out. Just never the way you planned.
Michael Kavanaugh is a freelance journalist currently working in Sudan. That's the voice of Miriam Makeba. The superstar from Africa died last November, but you can still hear her influence in the music of the many African musicians she inspired. Angelique Kidjo is one of them. Our guide to global music, Tendai Maposa, is here again to talk about her. Welcome, Tendai. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Peggy.
Let's talk a little about Angelique. How did she first start her singing career?
Angelique started off very early in life. She was only 6 when she started singing and dancing with her the country's theater group, of which her mother was the director. And then at 10, she heard Miriam Makeba. And she said, It was then that she realized that African music could be recorded for an international audience. When she heard Miriam Makeba, she decided that's what she wanted to do. She wanted to sing for the world, not just for Benin or for Africa.
What song would you recommend we listen to first that would really showcase what she's all about?
Well, I think, you know, we'd start off by paying homage to Miriam for influencing this 10-year-old to be an international artist, because I think if she hadn't had Miriam when she did, she wouldn't have done what she's doing today. And she actually paid tribute to Miriam by recording a song called Malaika, which was a huge hit for Miriam on her first album for a major label. I think it's the most covered African song.
Malaika, nakupenda malaika, ningekuwa mariwe, ningekuwa dada.
It's almost a little haunting, her voice there. It's beautiful. What's it about?
Well, it's about a guy. Malaika is my angel. He's singing to a beautiful woman and saying, if I had money, my Malaika, my angel, I would marry you, but I'm just so poor, I cannot.
Tendai, when did Angelique's music really take off?
In the early 80s, Angelique took off and went to Paris, where she intended to study law. But she said after attending two classes, she realized law was not for her because, as she said when I spoke to her, the law was written for and by white people. And she thought that that law did not see blacks as equals. And she said she wanted to fight for the rights of Africans, and she did not see how she could fight for the rights of Africans with that kind of law. And so she dropped out. And then she enrolled into a college of music. That's where she took music lessons. From then on, she started recording. She started singing in clubs and also started recording with a band and then by herself. And the very first album, I think, was released in 91.
So what kind of shape did her music take then after her time in Paris studying music? What did it take on a more Western influence, or did she go back to her African roots and really develop those?
It was a mix of both. I think Angelique never makes it a secret that she was really influenced by people like the Rolling Stones, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin. Those are people that she says she listened to as she grew up. But the African influence is still pretty strong in her music.
And she has stayed very rooted to Africa. I mean, she fights for a lot of African causes. She's a UNICEF Goodwill ambassador. And she actually has a song, I believe, called Africa, which talks about some of the things she cares about.
Yes, actually, I think what we have here is the live version, which she sang in South Africa in 2004.
How are you tonight?
At the inaugural 4664 concert for Nelson Mandela's Foundation. And 4664, incidentally, was Nelson's number when he was in prison.
Were you there?
I was there. When you hear that noise, I'm one of those voices.
What was that concert like for you?
Oh, it was amazing, especially when old Nelson shuffled onto the stage. It was just amazing. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to her song called Africa.
Let's do it!
What was she singing about in that song? What are the lyrics talking about?
No, she's just talking about Africa, how Africa is such a wonderful place and the beauty of African people.
You could hear everybody cheering. I thought I could hear your voice in there, Tendai. you were in that audience, and certainly that kind of music makes you want to get up and dance. Were you dancing?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody was up on their feet.
talk a little about her latest album, which is titled Jin Jin. It came out last year, and she even won a Grammy for it for Best Contemporary World Music. What do you like about this album?
Well, I see a lot of progress with every album that Angelique makes. It's better than the last one. There's always a lot of collaborations, but I just like the fact that from the very first time that I saw her, she has grown. She's been growing, and she's been also incorporating other influences into her music. She's been to Brazil, and she's also moved to the States. She now lives in Brooklyn, in New York City. She's always worked with, from the very beginning, she's worked with American artists. Branford Marsalis was on her first album.
She's worked with some very well-known musicians. I think on one song she brings in both Carlos Santana and Josh Groban, right?
Yeah, because actually she did say Santana was a major influence for her as well. So I think this was a good move.
Let's play a little bit from her song Pearl, where we'll hear Josh Groban and Carlos Santana playing with her.
There is a woman in Somalia scraping for pearls on the roadside.
There's a force stronger than nature keeps her will alive.
This is how she's dying. She's dying to survive.
All right, Tendai, thank you so much for being with us today.
Peggy, thank you very much. It's always fun.
I would like to be that way. She cries to the heaven above.
That was Tendai Maposa, our guide to global music. He spoke to us from Zimbabwe. Coming up, a writer from Iowa decides to find out where his clothes come from.
It kind of all started with one T-shirt. It was orange, had a tattoo from Fantasy Island on it. It said, "Follow me to my tropical paradise."
He did, and he ended up in Honduras. We'll hear his story and more ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. We're going to the Horn of Africa now, to a tiny region called Somaliland. Somaliland broke away from Somalia 17 years ago. The tiny nation has its own flag, its own national anthem, and its own passport. But Somaliland isn't recognized by the international community, and that means its citizens hold passports that are useless. Neighboring Somalia won't issue passports to people in the renegade province. And that creates a catch-22 for people who want to travel outside the country. It also creates a business opportunity for an enterprising young man. Richard Locke reports.
On a busy roadside, 26-year-old Hussein sits behind a metal box piled high with brick-sized bundles of cash. Hussein makes a living as a black market money changer, exchanging Somaliland shillings into US dollars. But look a little more closely and you'll spot his sideline. Wedged into the mound of bills is a single, brand spanking new, green passport. Emblazoned in gold print across the cover are the words, Republic of Somalia, the country Somaliland broke away from. It's illegal for us to hold a Somalia passport here, Hussein tells me, because our government says we're a separate country. But no one recognizes our passport, so to get travel visas, we have no option but to buy a Somalia passport. Obtaining the passport in the first place is no problem for Hussein. Somalia epitomizes the term dysfunctional state, and its border with Somaliland is as porous as international borders get. This might be the black market, but Hussein makes no effort to conceal what he's selling. The government doesn't bother us, he says. You know, they travel abroad and have to use a Somalia passport just like anyone else. So what can they do? So, for just $42, a Somalia passport can be yours. Just paste in a photo, enter your personal details, black ink is advised, and sign on the dotted line. There does appear to be one hurdle, however. The space reserved for the Minister of Immigration's signature. He sits hundreds of miles away in Mogadishu, a city engulfed by civil war. But not to worry, Hussein has a way of circumventing that. The minister doesn't sign it, he says. We forge his signature and stamp. So while Somalilanders look to the outside world for formal recognition, Hussein is quite happy capitalizing on Somaliland's passport to nowhere. The only problem is that he doesn't exactly do a brisk trade. In a good week, he'll sell only two or three passports. The vast majority of Somalilanders are too poor to travel anywhere. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Hargeisa, Somaliland.
Kelsey Timmerman gets good use out of his passport. Kelsey is a writer who lives in Ohio, but you never quite know where you'll find him because he's been spending a lot of time tracking down exactly where his clothes come from. And that means lots of overseas travel. Kelsey joins us to explain.
It kind of all started with one T-shirt. It was my favorite T-shirt for a couple years. It was orange, had a tattoo from Fantasy Island on it. And around the tattoo's head, it said, "Follow me to my tropical paradise." So I kind of wondered, well, Tattoo, you know, where is this tropical paradise of yours? You know, I'm from Ohio, and we have long winters, so tropical paradises always sound nice. Looked at the tag, and it was made in Honduras.
And you just decide to pack up and go to Honduras?
That's what I did.
To find out what?
Well, I just kind of wanted to find out where my shirt was made and just to learn who is actually making this T-shirt. So I just want to learn about his life. And, you know, in the USA now, we really hardly make anything. And I think too often we just put on our T-shirt, pull on our jeans, and we don't actually think about where our stuff comes from. And, you know, I think we should at least know something about those places and about those people.
So how do you do that?
All I did was I called the clothing company and I asked them, hey, you know, I want to go to Honduras to find the location where my T-shirt was made and kind of the address. And after laughing a little bit, they gave it to me and off I went.
Yeah, and so what did you discover there?
They were kind of, when I told them what I was doing there, I was just brutally honest. My T-shirt was made here, and I'd kind of like to look around. And they weren't having too much of that, and I eventually got with their PR person. And she basically was stonewalling me. She wouldn't even answer the most simple question I could ask her. I could ask her, how many people does it take to make this T-shirt? And she would just look at me.
Well, it's not hard to understand why she'd be stonewalling, isn't it? I mean, who would believe somebody walking up and say, you know, I came all the way from the United States just to see where my T-shirt was made?
Yeah, I don't blame her at all. I don't blame her. I wouldn't even let me in the door, you know?
So Kelsey, you didn't get everything you wanted in Honduras. You made your way back to the U.S., and instead of having gotten this out of your system, you decided to track down the origins of the rest of your clothes.
That is correct.
So what came next?
Well, what came next was my underwear. They're Christmas boxers, and they have these Christmas ornaments all over them. And they were made in Bangladesh, so that's where I'm talking to you from right now.
What have you learned since you've been in Bangladesh?
You know, it is the world's most densely populated country, and I believe it. And, you know, the people of Bangladesh are so nice and accommodating, so welcoming. Everyone wants me to stop for tea. I could drink 30 cups of tea a day, and everyone wants to bring me home and feed me. So it's not hard at all to make friends in Bangladesh.
Have you found the factory where your underwear was made?
I did.
What did this factory look like?
Well, from the outside, it was just a concrete building, and the conditions aren't that bad, but what is really bad is their pay. Some people get, like, 10 cents an hour, which equates to about $6 a week.
That's why your T-shirt is so cheap.
Yeah, it is.
And did you ever go home with any of these workers, Kelsey? Did you find out how they live?
Yes, I did. I met this whole building of garment workers that work in the city. And the building itself, I mean, it was really bad living conditions. You know, the smell, as soon as you walk in, is just awful. You just can't describe it. You can't, you feel it before you smell it in your nose. And the building itself looked like it had been gutted by a fire. And one particular lady I met, her name was Arafah, and she makes that minimum 10 cents per hour. You know, she has a daughter. Her daughter's around 4. And she lives in a room 7 foot by 12 foot with 6 other women who are also garment workers. So life is not great for these people.
Kelsey, has this surprised you or discouraged you in any way?
Well, I guess the lack of pay has surprised me. I knew that the people that made our clothes didn't get paid that much, but I figured that maybe their pay for living in Bangladesh was still maybe livable. But, you know, making $6 a week, it's not going to cut it. You're not going to be able to send your kids to school and improve their situation in life at all.
So I want to ask you, Kelsey, you followed your T-shirt, you followed your boxer shorts. What's next?
Well, next, my All-American blue jeans were made in Cambodia. So in a couple days, I will be heading to Phnom Penh, and we'll start the search for my blue jeans.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I really look forward to talking to you again.
Kelsey was heading to Cambodia to see where his jeans were made. He might have come across a small outdoor cafe on a shady side street of the capital. That's where Megan Williams went for coffee when she was in the city. In the beginning, it was the coffee that brought her back. Then it was the owner. Here's her story.
It's a brilliantly sunny afternoon in downtown Phnom Penh, Cambodia's sprawling capital. I've just finished an interview with the man who offers to buy me a coffee at a nearby stand. Dozens of cars are parked on a dusty lot to the side. This is where the city's taxi drivers hang out, waiting for work. Like so many of the businesses in this struggling city, the cafe consists of improvised comfort. Worn plastic chairs and tables set up under the shade of a leafy tree. A little stand holds an old-fashioned ice box and a gas burner to make the drinks. The coffee is served in a tall glass with a long spoon. It's unapologetically dense and sweet, with a thick dollop of condensed milk on the bottom. Pure bliss. Tucked behind the stand is a raised wooden platform. That's where the woman who runs the cafe rests under an umbrella. Her name is Savon. I learned this the next morning from a taxi driver who speaks English. She's an attractive woman in her late 40s, with olive weathered skin, erect posture, and alert eyes. There's also a constant unspoken sadness flickering in them. Later, the cabbie translates as I chat with Savon over lemonade, which is every bit as good as her coffee. Like almost every Cambodian over the age of 40 or so, Savon is a survivor of the Khmer Rouge, the brutal regime of the late 70s that murdered, starved, and overworked up to 2 million people. Savon was the only one of her family to survive. For more than 2 decades, she worked in a family-owned restaurant across the street. Savon also slept there, so when the restaurant closed down about a year ago, she was desperate. Cambodia is still a country of broken lives and haunting memories, but it's also a place where people look out for each other. The cab drivers, who were regulars at the restaurant, pulled together to help Savon. They cleared away a corner of the lot where they parked their cars and helped Savon set up her mini kitchen and plastic furniture the owners had left her. They pitched in to buy her some umbrellas for extra shade. They helped her set up the wooden platform where she sleeps each night. Despite the lack of walls and locked door, Savon says she feels safe. During my stay in Phnom Penh, I went back to that stand each day, and as I sat on one of Savon's plastic chairs and sipped my morning coffee, I felt as I often do when people struggling to get by share a small slice of their life with me. Grateful. And of course, also grateful for the best cup of coffee in all of Phnom Penh.
That was Megan Williams from Cambodia. If you'd like to see a photo of Savon at her coffee stand, you can find it on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And what goes better with coffee than dessert? How about chocolate? Did you know Mexico is the birthplace of chocolate? The story goes that a Mayan god presented his people with a gift from the Garden of Paradise, the cacao tree. That's where chocolate comes from. And nowhere in Mexico is chocolate held in higher esteem than in Oaxaca. They say every man, woman, and child in this southern Mexico city eats chocolate at least once a day. Reporter Mary Stuckey wanted to learn the secret of making hot chocolate Mexican style. So she turned to Pilar Cabrera, a well-known chef in Oaxaca. We join them on Mina Street.
We're at Chocolate Mayordomo, one of the very first chocolate stores to open in Oaxaca. We're buying the raw ingredients for chocolate atole, perhaps the most popular form of hot chocolate in Mexico.
And here we stop in the first place and start the business of chocolate in Oaxaca, Chocolate Mayordomo. Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. I prefer more proportion of almonds and less sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandmom. ¿Me puedes vender media molienda de...
Okay, so she is putting these cacao beans, oh, like big coffee beans, really, on an old-fashioned scale and weighing them in a big metal dish. After we buy the ingredients, we cross the street to where the grinders are. About half a dozen work in one huge shop whose doors are open to the busy street. Ancient grinding machines pulverize the cacao beans, almonds, sugar, and cinnamon. And then men mix the ingredients into a paste by hand using a knife. Now, even though we have the chocolate paste flavored with almond, cinnamon, and sugar, we're not going to make our own chocolate atole today. Instead, we'll take a short taxi ride to the market to join in a morning ritual in Oaxaca. This market is right next door to the school Pilar attended as a child.
We come into the market almost every day. Yeah, and for me, my best place is Comedor Mari. They prepare the best chocolate we have here in the city. We call chocolate atole. Doña Mari, venimos a visitarla.
Pilar greets the proprietor, Maria Ramirez Vasquez. The 70-year-old, wearing an apron and long braids, stands in front of a huge pot. Inside, dried corn is boiling in water. This is the corn atole, the base ingredient in the hot chocolate drink.
People cook the corn, dry corn, one day in advance. And this water, thick atole, because boiling and boiling, and at the end combined with the chocolate, without almonds, and a lot of cinnamon.
But there's a special way in which the thick corn and the chocolate are combined.
And use the molinillo to bring foamy on the top of the chocolate.
The molinillo is a foot-long wooden whisk. It's a lot of work to use it. There's no milk in this drink, but even without it, Maria whips up a substantial foam. The foam is said to contain the energy of the person who made the drink. That person must be a woman, whose worth as a cook is determined by how much foam she can create. Maria tells Pilar she makes 30 liters of chocolate atole every day to sell in the market. That's a lot of whisking.
At the end, serve in a big bowl with a wooden spoon. We stir the mixture, and then we're drinking, and I feel the delicious flavor of the chocolate, and the combination with the corn atole is great. Do you want to try it?
Nothing like our hot chocolate. It's completely different. This isn't so sweet.
Yeah.
And no milk in this.
No milk. Doña Mari. Nos vemos.
Time to go. Chocolate atole is a breakfast drink, and the morning is passing. As we leave, we spot two schoolgirls, heads bent over huge bowls of Doña Maria's hot chocolate.
bebe chocolate cada día?
Sí.
The girls say they start each day with a bowl of chocolate atole, just like countless generations before them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Oaxaca, Mexico.
They say in Oaxaca, hot water with chocolate. They say in Oaxaca, hot water with chocolate. They say at the fiesta, the burning of lights will tell.
And that's it for the show this week. Don't forget to visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can download podcasts, you can read blogs, and you can post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
You first need to get the peanuts. You get the salt and the bread. You grind and you fry the chilies. You boil the chocolate. Get cinnamon and banana. Get cloves and oregano. Get thyme.